Right now at the Home Depot, you'll save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like a GE appliance's top load washer and dryer pair. With deep clean and deep rinse options, a reliable heavy-duty agitator, and four precise water levels, just $4.78 each. Wash, dry, save, repeat. Today is the day for doing. With Spring Black Friday savings, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. Gas, dryer, extra, see store for details, valid through April 17th.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. Today, we're going to be talking about understanding fertility medications. This is an area that I think there is more confusion in than just about any other, and that's saying a lot because there's a lot of confusing things in the world of infertility. I think you are really going to enjoy this show. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
You would never or should never see a cycle that has both follistim and gonal-F unless there's a shortage and you have to switch from one to the other because they're essentially the same product. There's different pens that they come in, but overall, they're equivalent. Menopur is different because it's not pure FSH. It's a mixture of FSH and LH. The majority of physicians in the country do like a combination of either follistim and Menopur or gonal-F and Menopur.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am your host and the director of Creating a Family, and you can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. The Creating a Family radio show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. For women who have been undergoing fertility treatment and are still struggling to conceive, there are daily scenarios and interactions that honestly just take a toll on your emotional health. There is an app out there for that. There's an app for everything, but there's an app out there for that, and it's called Ferticalm, F-E-R-T-I-C-A-L-M, Ferticalm. And it's for both Apples and Androids. And it's developed by Dr. Ali Domar. She is a friend of our show. We've had her on a number of times, as well as Dr. Elizabeth Grill. And it was designed to help women address the many challenging and emotional life situations that come up when you're struggling to conceive. To get more information about it, you can go to their website, FertiCalmApp.com. That's FertiCalmApp.com. Today, we're going to be talking about understanding fertility medications. We're going to be talking with Adam Height. He is with SHRAFS 2.0. He is the president of SHRAFS 2.0 Specialty Pharmacy. He is a registered pharmacist, and he is accredited by the American Council of Apothecaries as a fertility pharmacist. Welcome, Adam, to Creating a Family.
Thank you so much.
You know, I said at the very beginning that this is an area where I think there is so much confusion. And honestly, one of the things that I, and this is not a plug for SHRAFS, although SHRAFS is one of our partners and Adam is with SHRAFS, that you have a program that I think is so smart. It's called Open the Box. And I love this program because I can't tell you how many people we hear from when their fertility meds, you're going through fertility treatment, and your meds usually come by mail. And so a box is delivered, and there is this overwhelming, sinking feeling in your heart when you open up this box and you are staring at a box full of drugs and usually needles, and there's just so much there. And there is, I mean, honestly, I don't know of a single patient who doesn't have this sinking feeling at that point. You're just so overwhelmed. And the program, the Open the Box program, I don't know if it's a take on the common things you see now on anytime you buy any tech product, there's usually a video called Open the Box on that product, and it's by people who have bought the product, and they open it and they peel off the stuff. And I watch those, you know, when I've just got a new iPad, and I checked out the Open the Box, tells you how to set it up and all that. So it may not be a twist on that, but it was it. I'm kind of curious.
It's not really a twist on that, but effectively, when I reopen SHRAFS, because SHRAFS 2.0 is a rebirth, of a company I created back 15 years ago. One of the number one items that I wanted to address was what you're talking about. We receive a call from a patient, or when we reach out to a patient and let them know we have a referral for them, most of the time they've just come from their doctor's office. They've talked with their nurse. As per our accreditations, we always ask if they have any questions for the pharmacist. And I would say 9 times out of 10, the answer is no, because A, the patient just came from the doctor's office. They were told to go watch videos, or they had a quick introduction to what the medications are. And they're a little overwhelmed because they just were discussing their insurance and delivery, and now is just not the time.
Yeah.
And then, as you put it, the box shows up. There are, 8 to 10 different medications, 3 to 4 different supplies. Some of it is refrigerated, some of it's not. And now this sinking feeling, as you were talking about, sets in. And now what do I do? And I'm stuck. And we wanted to give another opportunity for the patient, not only to have time to speak with one of our nurses or our pharmacists, but to ask more questions and to give them that feeling of we're here with you. We're going to go through this process together. And as questions come up, you do have a resource. And we're available 24/7. We want you to know that. So it was really just, I know it's a huge issue, and we could not address it up front, so we decided to address it after the fact.
And you know, that is the time to address it, because it's when you're looking, all the information in the world that comes in ahead of time, it's not that it goes in one ear and out the other, but it does a little, only because when you're staring at the 5 different vials and you're staring at 15 different, syringes and a couple of different needles that go on different, it's at that point you go, oh gosh, I don't even know where to begin. And it's they're in adult education, which is something that we do here at Creating a Family with nurse education and things like that. There's a term that's called educable moment. That's kind of the term that experts use. And if you want to talk about an educable moment, when you're staring at a box full,
when you're really nervous,
and you're nervous and you're thinking, oh God, I've got to do this. That is the ultimate educable moment. So we're going to we'll do our own little semi version of Open the Box. It won't be the same, because of course it's going to be generic and not specific to the patient. But anyway, I love that concept. So let's start where a lot of people begin, and that is with the oral medications. As far as I know, there's kind of 2 general ones. Let's start with clomiphene citrate. First of all, tell us the brand names, and then tell us a little about that.
So clomiphene citrate and letrozole, I'm assuming, is the other one you're talking about.
Correct,
Clomiphene, the original brand name is Clomid. Letrozole, the brand name is Femara. They work slightly differently. However, both will indirectly increase the amount of estradiol and therefore increase the amount of what we'll call, because we're going to get into this in far greater detail, FSH and LH. And so both work, like I said, slightly differently by blocking a different receptor site, which confuses the pituitary and then induces the release of estradiol, FSH, and LH. So FSH is follicle-stimulating hormone. LH is luteinizing hormone. FSH, when in decent concentrations, will mature the follicles in the ovary. That's obviously what we're trying to do. And LH, the LH surge, is what triggers ovulation. And so usually as step one for a patient, assuming this is an alternative type a therapy that is appropriate for them, you would start with something as least invasive as possible. Obviously, an oral medication that you take over 5 to 10 days is less invasive than doing injectables. And so you see very frequently patients would start with either Clomid or clomiphene, because Clomid, the brand name, is no longer available, or letrozole. And depending on the doctor and your specific diagnosis, it could be something that you take one day. You can take it over 5 days. You can take it over 10 days. And then in some cases, you would add a small amount of the injectable, which we'll get into, and or a trigger shot, which we'll also get into. But again, this would be the least invasive and indirectly would increase the amount of estradiol, FSH, and LH, which will lead to the maturation of the follicles in the ovary.
Gotcha. And so that is, it's often the first step. It's used sometimes by itself, where there, and sometimes with intrauterine insemination, IUIs, and sometimes it's prescribed by OBGYNs, and then sometimes once people have actually gotten to a reproductive endocrinologist, and that is shortened to RE, so our fertility clinic, our infertility clinic. So that's the oral meds. Now, walk us through, and that's the easiest part. So, although I will say that when we have a huge online support group, and when we oftentimes people will say, I want to start easy or something along those lines. So I definitely want to start with one of the oral meds. Inevitably, somebody will post and say, oh, it's not easy because there are side effects, but
exactly.
But it is less invasive. That's for certain. So, yeah. All right. Now, let's assume that somebody is now with their reproductive endocrinologist. Let's walk through, and let's assume that they are IVF has been. It's been decided that IVF in vitro fertilization is likely the treatment of choice. So, if you could walk us through some of the different scenarios, kind of from the beginning of an IVF cycle. Through, and let's talk about the different types of medications that may be used. And let me say up front that the decision of specific types of medication is made by a medical doctor, your reproductive endocrinologist. But we're going to be talking about them in general. So walk us through. Go ahead.
I was just going to add, we do see OBGYNs prescribing some of the FSH products, the injectables, in small quantities, but when you start to move towards IVF, it really does need to be a reproductive endocrinologist. The medications, while very effective, if not used appropriately, if not monitored correctly, they do require a prescription for a reason. They can be dangerous, and so you do need to be seeing someone who is very qualified and knows how to monitor your progress.
Yes, thank you.
So with that said, I would simply start with, when I train my new pharmacists or my new people here, I break down the medications by classification. And so I look at the medications as a whole and what do we need to do, let's say, an IVF cycle. And you can have medications that prepare you to do a IVF cycle. And by that I mean, you could have an oral contraceptive. That way they shut down your cycle as a whole and can start it when they are prepared to start it. You can also use something like Leuprolide, and we're going to go into great detail on Leuprolide because Leuprolide is kind of like that magic medication that can do everything. And so the first classification is preparing for the cycle. And I would list those two as where we would talk when we are trying to prepare. And obviously you can take multivitamins, and if there's an issue with your thyroid, you could be on thyroid medicine. But overall, what we're going to see is the oral contraceptive and or Leuprolide. And I'm going to go deeper into Leuprolide, I think, later after we go through each of the pieces and parts. After we prepare and now it's time to start our cycle, I call the second classification stimulants. And so when I say stimulants, it's not like Sudafed or anything like that. We're talking about stimulating the ovaries to mature the follicles so they can be more readily prepared for ovulation. And in this classification, we have FSH products or recombinant FSH, one being Follistim made by Merck, one being Gonalef made by EMD Serono. Both of those are recombinant FSH or follicle-stimulating hormone. It does exactly what it says it's going to do. It stimulates the follicles to mature. You also have a product called Menopure, which is a mixture of FSH and LH. And whereas Follistim and Gonalef are both recombinant, meaning that they're made in a lab, Menopure is actually made from urine. And is like I said, it's a one-to-one ratio of FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone, and LH. Now, you would never or should never see a cycle that has both Follistim and Gonalef unless there's a shortage and you have to switch from one to the other because they're essentially the same product. There's different pens that they come in, but overall, they're equivalent. Menopure is different because it's not pure FSH. It's a mixture of FSH and LH. The majority of physicians in the country do like a combination of either Follistim and Menopure or Gonalef and Menopure. As an alternative, there are some physicians in the country that use a compound, and we're going to go into a little bit of detail here, but there's a product called HCG or human chorionic gonadotropin. Brand name would be Pregno or Novero, or a recombinant version of HCG called Avadrel. The products Pregno comes in 10,000 international units per vial. The Avadrel and Novero are equivalent to 5,000 units of HCG. There are some physicians in the country that will use a dilution of this HCG as low as 10 international units, so effectively 1/1,000th or 1/500th of the dose that it comes in commercially. And the rationale here is 10 IU of HCG is equivalent to 75 IU, and IU stands for international units, of LH. And so you would see Follistim used with Menopure or Gonalef used with Menopure, or you would see those first two, Follistim and Gonalef, used with low-dose HCG. So let's back up for a second.
That would be used in combination. The HCG, the human chorionic gonadotropins, is used in combination, usually, with one of the other, either the recombinant human FSH, Follistim or Gonalef, or with the human gonadotropin, menopausal gonadotropin, Menopure.
Correct.
Okay, and one quick question, too, about the human chorionic gonadotropins. Is that by injection as well?
So everything we're talking about now, as we started, the stimulants are by injection.
Okay,
so
gotcha.
Follistim and Gonalef come as a cartridge that is used in a pen, so similar to a insulin pen, if you know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cartridge fits in, or Gonalef, it's already preloaded, and you dial your dose. So in today's world, the usage of those products is considerably easier than it used to be. Menopure is what we call a lyophilized vial. So it is a powder that needs to be reconstituted. As is HCG, it's a powder that needs to be reconstituted. And so you're doing some mixing. You become sort of like a chemist. You do the mixing, and then you're doing the injecting. And so if you're doing a combination of Follistim or Gonalef with Menopure or low-dose HCG, it is effectively two shots.
Mm-hmm.
What I was going to back up and say, Follistim and Gonalef come in different strengths, but you can think of everything in 75 international unit equivalents. And so Menopure is a 1-to-1 ratio of 75 IU FSH, 75 IU LH. Follistim and Gonalef, you're going to dial up your dose to some version of 75 IU, whether it's 75 IU, 150, 2.25, 300, 450, 375, you're going to have some sort of dose that you're dialing it up to. And then if you're using low-dose HCG, as I said initially, 10 IU of low-dose HCG is equivalent to 75 IU of LH. And so you can effectively add as much FSH as required, and then you would add LH through the cycle to prepare the follicles to be as mature as possible in preparation for ovulation.
And this may not be in your wheelhouse of expertise, but what's the research behind, or what's the thought behind using the HCG, that's the human chorionic gonadotropins, the Pregnol or the Ovadril or the Novarel? What's the thought behind adding that to a cycle?
Well, research shows that having some LH through the cycle is beneficial in most cases. And the rationale of using low-dose HCG instead of Menopur is two-part. The first part is you can control exactly how much LH you have because you can do 75 IU alone, whereas Menopur, you're going to get FSH with it. There was a product in this country called Luveris. It's still sold overseas, which is just 75 IU of LH.
Okay. But that's not available here.
No longer.
All right.
Correct.
Okay. So now those are, and what you were talking about, just to get everybody back on the same page, is this is the stimulant part of the IVF cycle. And not to be overly simplistic, but the IVF, one of the beginning of IVF is to stimulate the ovaries to produce, and there are different, doctors have different theories on this, but I think it still seems to be more often that the theory here is to produce not as many as, but a larger number of eggs. And so that's what everything we're talking about now is to stimulate the ovaries to produce more than one egg, because generally in a menstrual cycle only one egg will be produced. Okay,
correct.
So this
and
is.
I was going to add.
Go ahead. Yeah, please. Yeah.
In a normal cycle, reproductive cycle, the FSH and LH that's released by the pituitary is picked up by the follicles, and each month, on average, or primarily. One of those follicles becomes dominant. And for lack of a better term, it becomes so dominant that it doesn't allow any of the other follicles in the ovary to get any of the hormone. And so each month, only one follicle gets to the point of being mature. And once that follicle is mature is what triggers what we'll call an LH surge or ovulation. And therefore, only one follicle is released. What we're doing here is more what we'll call controlled ovarian hyperstimulation. We're intentionally putting so much FSH and so much LH present at the ovaries that there is more than enough hormone for more than one follicle. And so, yes, the intention is to produce 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 follicles that are mature and then to retrieve them.
Gotcha, and that's the beginning part. All right, so now that's the gonadotropin aspect of our that we're talking about. Let's
correct.
Move through.
And
all right, we're going through a cycle, and we've produced at this point. We're hoping, and we are the ovaries now have a number of mature eggs. All right, what's the next?
Before we get to when they're mature.
Okay.
As we were just talking about, when the body identifies that we have a mature follicle, it will look to ovulate. And we're hyperstimulating, controlled, the ovaries, so we know that they're going to get some of the follicles mature before we get as many as we actually like. So we need some way to block ovulation.
Oh, yeah, that was where I was coming to. Excellent. Yes, good.
And so... In order to block ovulation, there are two different options. The most common today would be to use what we call an antagonist. There are two available in this industry. One is called Ganirelix, and one is called Cetratide or Cetrorelix. And they both sit on the pituitary, on the receptor site, and will block the LH surge and not allow it to occur. I will point out these are competitive antagonists, which means if you put enough medication that causes LH surge, it can move these blockers off of the receptor site. However, when present, barring you forcing the issue, they will both block ovulation. And so we've now been able to stimulate controlled blocking the ovulation by using one of these two products. And then when you're ready, you would move forward. There is another way to block ovulation, and it's going to be that same product that I think we should go through at the end, Leuprolide. So I did fail to mention that Leuprolide can also act as a stimulant. It can prepare you for doing an IVF cycle. It can stimulate the pituitary to release FSH and LH. It can also act as a blocker, and I'll go into detail on how it does all of it, but I just wanted to mention it for right now until we get through all the rest of them, and then we'll kind of do Leuprolide all on its own because it's a little bit more difficult to understand.
Okay, so but going back to the antagonist, the release hormones, it releases the gonadotropins. It blocks the ovulation is what it does, and so that allows the other eggs that are slower to mature to catch up, because the idea is that we want to get as many mature eggs as possible. And if we don't do that, then the egg that has reached maturity will ovulate. And the idea is to keep them all there until we're ready for them to ovulate. So then how is that medication taken? And when in the cycle is it taken generally?
So you wouldn't need to take it on day one because the odds are you're not going to have a mature follicle on day one. But somewhere around day 4 to 6 of your stimulation, you're very likely going to have the possibility of ovulation. And the last thing we'd like to have happen is for ovulation to happen prematurely. And so you would start somewhere between day 4 and 6, and then you would continue using the antagonist on a daily basis throughout the rest of your cycle until it's time to ovulate. Ganirelix comes in a preloaded syringe, so it's preloaded. All you have to do is take the cap off and inject. Cetratide comes with a preloaded syringe of diluent, so you're not measuring anything, but you do have to inject the diluent, or the water, let's call it, into the powder, change the needle, and then do the injection. So far, all of the different products we're talking about, these injections are subcutaneous.
And we're going to come around to that in a minute. After we talk about the drugs, we're going to be talking about the administering and subcutaneous and injection sites and all of that. Okay, so now we've talked about stopping ovulation. So we've got ovaries, which hopefully have been stimulated, and we have a number of maturing or mature eggs. We have stopped those eggs from releasing from the ovaries because we want to capture them all. What's the next step, and what drugs do we talk about at that point?
So now we've stimulated, we've blocked, we have mature follicles, we need to trigger. And so a trigger, this is to force the follicles out of the ovary or to cause ovulation. Our full dose HCG, or Novarel, or Pregnyl, or Avadril. And we'll go, well, as I said before, when they were being used as a stimulant, 10 IUs of HCG is equivalent to 75 IUs of LH. Pregnyl, generic HCG come as 10,000 IUs. Novarel and Avadril are equivalent to 5,000 IUs. And so that's a lot of LH. And that is our LH surge. And that LH surge is what triggers the ovaries to ovulate. There is another medication here, and it's that same one we keep talking about, Leuprolide can also be used to trigger ovulation. And in today's industry, it is becoming more and more common to see either Leuprolide as a sole trigger or a combination of HCG or one of the other products and Leuprolide as a dual trigger.
And that's based on research that's been coming out indicating that we have better success doing that. Is that correct?
Correct. It's not even so much, it is better success, yes. Even more, I won't say more important, but just as important, a much lower incidence of hyperstimulation. And so we talked earlier.
Why don't you explain what hyperstimulation is real quickly?
So, as I said initially, we're doing something called controlled ovarian hyperstimulation. And so as we go through this process, there's going to be blood tests and ultrasounds to keep an eye on the follicles, to keep an eye on estradiol levels, FSH levels, and pretty much every type of level that can be followed to ensure we do not cause true hyperstimulation. So hyperstimulation, when the body gets somewhat out of control, and considerable side effects can occur, and they can be sometimes considerably dangerous. And so towards the end of a cycle, if not monitored correctly, or if the human body is obviously very intriguing, it can get out of control, and it would force us to want to trigger faster or to ensure that the patient does not truly hyperstimulate. And so Leuprolide has been shown to have a much lower incidence of hyperstimulation versus HCG or Pregnol or Avadrol.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, what's exciting is that we really are making some advances in this field, and our success rates are showing it. So that's wonderful, and something that I think it's really important when we're talking with patients for them to. Sometimes it's easy to get discouraged, especially if you've been trying for a while. But it's really amazing. We're gearing up for the big conference, that our medical conference every year, and I come away the American Society of Reproductive Medicine conference. And I come away every year feeling excited and about what the future is going to bring. So let me pause a moment and remind you that you are listening to Creating a Family, and today we are talking about understanding infertility medications. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, would not happen and could not happen without the support of our partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information and support to the patient community. And one of our wonderful sponsors and partners is Schrath 2.0 Specialty Fertility Pharmacy. In fact, we're talking with their president today, Adam Hyatt. Schrath 2.0 believes that pharmacy care can and should be remarkable. All employees, from pharmacist to shipping coordinator, understand the stress of fertility treatment and are trained to treat customers with dignity, empathy, and respect. For more information on Schrath 2.0, you can go to their website, schrath2.com. That's schrafts2.com. All right, Adam, now we have talked about the point of, we've gotten up to the point where we have stimulated the ovaries, we have stopped them from ovulating while we let all the eggs catch up, and then, and I realize I'm making gross summaries and generalizations, but, and we have now talked about shots, and everything at this point has been injectables, shots, and now we've talked about the triggers, which is saying, okay, we've got all the eggs we're going to get, they are mature, and now we're going to trigger ovulation. All right, and you've talked about the HCG, and you've talked about Leuprolide. Now, is there any other medications at this point? And if not, then what's the next step?
So at this point, we've now triggered ovulation. The next, I guess, classification would be, how do we support pregnancy? We have effectively fooled the body. It has not gone through the normal processes, if that's even, you know, a term. And so in a normal reproductive cycle, you would have estradiol as dominant for the first half to the latter half, and then progesterone starts to take over. Because we have not gone through the normal processes, progesterone levels are not as high as they should be, and we now have to get the body to a point where it would be able to support a pregnancy. And with that said, in today's industry, we have many that go through this process, get to the trigger, retrieve the eggs, and could do in vitro fertilization, and then freeze the embryo until a future date. I'm talking about the support that would be required after implantation. Because at this point, if you were freezing an embryo or just freezing your eggs, effectively the cycle has come to a close. Mm-hmm. We have what we need, and now it's just time to move forward. But if we are doing a fresh transfer or we are doing a transfer at a future date, we now need to convince the body that it's pregnant and be able to support it. And so effectively at this point, not all, but the majority of medications are going to be either progesterone in some form, and there are many of them, and or estradiol in some form. And again, there are many of them. And I'll just list a few.
Okay.
Progesterone in oil, whether it be sesame oil or olive oil or ethyl oleate or some other oil, is the most common for IVF cycles. This is an intramuscular shot and is not all that pleasant. But there's been tons of research and there's been tons of research trying to prove it's not necessary, that you can use other forms, and the research continues to come back that progesterone injected intramuscularly does increase success rates. And so you have progesterone in oil. You have a product called Endometrin, which is a vaginal insert or a vaginal tablet, which is progesterone. You can use Prometrium or its generic, which is a it's approved as an oral capsule, but we see it used orally and vaginally. You can have different progesterone capsules and progesterone suppositories. So that would be on the progesterone side. And then
the progesterone. Let me stop for a moment. And the progesterone, just to make everybody make sure we're all on the same page. At this point, what we're trying to do is make certain that there is a nice thick endometrium lining, and normally the woman's body produces this, but if we've not mimicked a natural cycle. If you're doing a fresh transfer, we've got to trick the body into realizing that it needs to be preparing for an embryo to implant. Now, if we're doing a frozen embryo transfer, which is becoming more common now, we don't do fresh, we'll freeze all, or if you don't freeze all and you still have some left over. The body could go through a natural cycle oftentimes because we want to be able to control the exact timing. It doesn't go through, but if a woman were to go through a natural cycle, would she need to add the progesterone if she is going to have a frozen embryo transfer and it's not a fresh transfer?
It would be up to obviously the physician.
Right.
In a normal cycle, towards the end of the cycle, we should see the endometrium lining thickening. You should be more prepared. However, my gut feeling is the majority of physicians would still probably want you to have some other form of progesterone until they were 100% confident of implantation and were ready to discharge at the end of, let's say, the first trimester.
Okay, got it. All right,
and
just
the other
going back
would be,
as
Well, I was going to say, we discussed progesterone. You can also have estradiol, the most common estrogen in the body. And you can get estradiol in tablets, patches, so transdermal, injectable as well. And so there's going to be some sort of combination of the two to ensure that the endometrial lining is exactly the way the physician wants it and at the peak for implantation.
Okay. So at that point, we're getting a nice, rich endometrial lining. We're talking about supporting a pregnancy at this point. And then the embryo is transferred. All right, so at that point, we do continue with the progesterone usually. And again, just to remind everybody that the actual protocol that you will follow will be determined by your doctor and will be tailored to you. But we're just talking in general now. So what's the next step from a drug standpoint or medication standpoint?
Well, at this point, we would support and, fingers crossed, discharge from your reproductive endocrinologist at the end of approximately the first trimester. We would then sit back and keep our fingers crossed for the next 6 months or so. and then, obviously, we look to have a baby. But I wanted to just go back real quickly and go through why leuprolide actually can work as everything.
Okay.
And so leuprolide is chemically gonadotropin-releasing hormone. And so the gonadotropins we've been talking about are FSH and LH. And so when leuprolide is introduced to the body, it acts on the pituitary causes the release, as you might imagine, of FSH and LH. It's gonadotropin-releasing hormone. It hits the receptor site and asks for the release of those two. And therefore, it acts as a stimulant. Depending on the dosage and the frequency of the gonadotropin-releasing hormone reaching the pituitary determines how the pituitary acts. 100% of the time, if leuprolide is introduced and it's the first or second dose, it causes the release of FSH and LH. Now, the body is very, very, as I said before, intricate and intriguing. If the pituitary is receiving a dosage or a frequency of this hormone, it will act as if something is wrong. It will be a marker that something is not working correctly in the body. And so if it continues to receive an unusual dosage or an unusual frequency of the medication, the pituitary will shut down the system. The first dose is always going to be a release of FSH and LH, but if you continue at an unusual dosage over a period of time, let's say 7 to 10 days, it will actually turn off the release of FSH and LH. And so we talked about you can prepare for a cycle by using leuprolide, and it's a little bit of older school thought. They would use leuprolide first over a period of, let's say, 2 weeks, and that would shut off FSH and LH that was in the body, and therefore you'd have a clean slate, shall we say. In very small doses is a little bit more what the pituitary is looking for, so we call these a flare cycle. And so it acts as a stimulant and can act as a stimulant for a longer period of time. But even the smaller doses will eventually cause what we call downregulation and the shutoff of this system or the release of FSH and LH from the pituitary. So if it shuts everything down, it can also act as a blocker. Because once it shuts everything down, unless you are going to use a trigger like HCG or Pregnyl or Novoril or Avadril, you're not going to be able to trigger ovulation because the pituitary release of FSH and LH is turned off and therefore blocked. And then it could also be used as a trigger because, as I said, if you were not using leuprolide prior and you used a high dose of leuprolide, it's going to cause a large release of FSH and LH in its first and or second shot. And therefore, it can be used to trigger ovulation in a more, I'll say, quote, natural way, because it's coming from your own pituitary. And so I hope that made sense. But effectively, Luprolide fits and can do prep, stimulant, blocker, and trigger, all with the same medication.
Is there any other drug in the same category as Luprolide, or is it unique in its what it's doing?
There are other products, not really in use in the fertility space, but there are other products like Luprolide. Now, this is a what we'll call an aqueous version of Luprolide that we use in the fertility space. Some patients and or some people may have seen Luprolide in a long-acting form, which is used for endometriosis and or different forms of cancer, and the mechanism is the same. The intention would be to turn off the pituitary's release of these gonadotropins.
Mm-hmm. And you do see it, people, you do see it used in, particularly I see it used with endometriosis because of the popular, what our audience is primarily in the trying to conceive. So in endometriosis is something we talk about. Okay, and we do
see it, just so you understand, I do get a lot of questions. In endometriosis, the dosage is just under 4 milligrams. And it's a long-acting form of Lupron, so it lasts a month. Whereas we see very commonly 4 milligrams used twice, so a total of 8 milligrams, used over a 12-hour period to trigger ovulation.
Yeah.
And so we do get questions that, you know, patients are concerned, how could something that's good for a whole month, how could I be taking double in 12 hours? And it's because we're looking for that high release of LH, whereas the long-acting version is doing the blocking or the turning off of the system. So it's not looking for the release. There's going to be a release up front, but over that period of that month or longer, it's going to turn off these hormones.
Okay, and the brand name for Luprolide is Luprin. And it is taken through injection as well.
Correct. In our industry, subcutaneously, we did discuss endometriosis, it would be intramuscularly.
Okay, well, let's move into talking about what we mean by that. Why are first of all, let's say, what is subcutaneous and what is, well, I think we all know what intramuscular is, but describe the difference between the two.
So a subcutaneous shot will be one that we're going to inject just into the top portion of the skin. So the needle is going to be very small will be considerably less painful with less what we'll call injection site reactions, whereas intramuscular is going to be a larger needle because we have to go deep into the muscle. Usually would be something that is more long-acting. So subcutaneous would be, I'll say, more aqueous. So it's a thinner solution that gets injected just underneath the skin. And intramuscular would be more oily and would be injected into the muscle for a longer-acting medication.
And the example of the intramuscular in oil was the progesterone that you mentioned, and part of the reason it's more painful is it's thicker, it's in oil, and the other one is it's into a muscle. So for both reasons, it is it tends to be a more, shall we say, tender shot.
Correct.
So
it is definitely the one that gets the most complaints.
Yes, most complaints. There you go. Well, let's talk a little about injection and injection pain. Some people are just really tense about shots, let's be honest. For some people, doing the shots is just not that big of a deal. They don't have a fear about it, and they can do it. So I don't want people to be turned off by the very thought, because I think that really describes a fair number. And after the first couple of times, it's no longer feels weird or unusual, and you don't look forward to it, but it's not horrible. But there are other people who just...
The vast majority of our patients, the fear is, can I mix this correctly? Will I get the right dosage? And am I capable of really injecting myself?
Yeah.
And once you do it once or twice, it's sort of like running downhill. Our patients become empowered. After you've done it a few times, I don't want to, belittle it, but after you've done it a few times, it becomes rather easy to use these medications. So it is just that initial fear that has to be conquered.
You are exactly right. That is, and we hear that all the time. And I will say that if you have a partner who is helping you, it may be fear of your partner giving you the shot, not fear of your giving yourself the shot. And that might be a greater fear, but that's a whole other issue and a whole other show.
And you do have the partners that are afraid to hurt their partner.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think that's, yeah. And maybe that'd be better than a partner who's not afraid to hurt. So let's just be thankful, perhaps. For people who have a real concern about injection site pain, are there some topical things that can be used to numb the area? We always tell people, if you're worried about it, put ice on it. But other than the ice trick, and there's some advantages and disadvantages to that trick, are there other things that people can do to lessen the actual injection pain?
There are. There are a few different topical creams and or patches. One is called Sanera. It's a patch that you would put on the site prior to using. It's lidocaine, and that helps to numb the area. I don't know if Emla is still available, but Emla was a cream that you could do the same with, and it was just lidocaine and prilocaine, so it was two anesthetics that you would put on the skin to help so you don't feel the pain. And so either one is possible, and yes, I would say ice, but yes, there are positive and negative to everything. And then, and this would be for the intramuscular. I don't think you would need this as much for the subcutaneous, but then in an intramuscular shot to then massage the area. And again, there's positive and negative to doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. Utilizing the muscle afterwards, if you do a push-up, or I can't do push-ups, but getting up against the wall, trying to utilize a muscle also makes it less tender, or at least in theory, can do that. All right.
And there's one other I'll just mention. I have never seen it used, but I've heard a bit about it. It's called Shot Blocker.
I've never heard of it.
Sort of like taking, what's the right word for it, a soft, it's not a needle, but it looks like a needle, and you would put it on the skin and push down to cause some pain and therefore deaden the pain receptor and then inject after it. I've never seen it used, but I've heard it talked about recently.
Interesting. Okay, well, all right, audience, if anybody has had experience with that, please come either send us an email at info@creatingafamily.org or drop by our Facebook support group, facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily, or just type in the words creating a family and post about it on there as well. I'd like to hear more about it. All right. Let me pause a moment to remind everyone that you are listening to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. Today we're talking about understanding infertility medications. Let me remind everyone that this show and all the resources are supported by and really brought to you by our partners. One of our wonderful partners is Fairfax Cryobank. They have been a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years. And are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. All right. Adam Height, who is the president of SHRAS 2.0 Fertility Specialty Fertility Pharmacy, is our guest today. That's easy for me to say, right? Let's talk about injection sites. Why does it matter where on our body we inject these medications?
Well, in the big picture, there's not a huge differential, but if you do a subcutaneous shot in the belly, it's easy for you to see. It's less painful, and I'll say relatively simple. Whereas if you are doing an intramuscular injection, you're not going to want to do that in the belly. First of all, there's not enough muscle, or there's not enough soft muscle that you could go through, and obviously the needle is much larger. And so for an intramuscular injection, we recommend the buttocks. And for a subcutaneous injection, we would recommend the belly.
So what happens if you're doing a subcutaneous injection and you're afraid you've gotten it into the muscle, you've gone too deep? Does that negate the effectiveness of the medication?
It does not. It's still going to work. The needle itself, assuming you use the correct needle, is not really long enough for you to get too deep. And so it should not make any difference. In fact, on a subcutaneous injection such as with Follistim and Gonalef, which comes with the needles, you instead of doing what we used to train our pharmacists and our nurses on how to give a subcutaneous injection where you would go effectively perpendicular to the skin, we mm-hmm. recommend today to just go directly into the skin. And so the needles are very short. It would be very difficult to do that, quote, wrong.
Okay. Well, what about the intramuscular, which, again, the primary one we've talked about is the progesterone. So what about an intramuscular? What if you either don't go deep enough? I guess it's going to be kind of hard if you're going into the buttocks to miss the muscle itself. But what if you miss and you go too shallow and you don't get it into the muscle? Is it not effective?
It's still going to be effective if it was truly too shallow. And, again, this would be, I think, somewhat difficult, assuming you use the entire needle. It might dissipate quicker. And so progesterone is long-acting. It acts over a long period of time. If it truly was injected, I wouldn't even say subcutaneously, but close to subcutaneously, you could see it cleared from the body much quicker. And so that would be the only downside, but your doctor will be monitoring your progesterone levels, and so it would be very evident if mm-hmm. there was a dip in that concentration.
All right, we got two questions that are kind of similar. One, a little of the medication leaked out of the injection site. Did that mess up my dose? And the second one, from Deanna, said, my husband squirted some of the med out when he was trying to make sure there was no air bubbles. Is that going to matter? So they seem similar. I'll read them together. So let's talk about that. The first one, where you see liquid coming out from the injection site. Do you need to worry that the dosage is not accurate?
The amount of medication that might leak from the injection site is likely very minor. And so, no, I don't think it would make any difference. This is a process that again, you're going to be monitored on a daily or every other day basis. And so your physician will know exactly how you're responding. It is not all that uncommon to have some medication, I'll say, quote, leak out. And as far as the other question, the amount of that would probably be squirted out of the syringe, I also believe would be very minor, unless there was a twitch. And so if we're doing one of the stimulants, let's say it's Follistim or Gonalef, you're dialing your dose. And so you should not be pushing, let's say, a plunger. Whereas if you are doing HCG or Menopure, and yes, you are looking to clear out any of the air bubbles. It is possible to have some leak out, but no, I don't believe it would be. It would change how you would respond.
Okay. And any suggestions? Do most people do their own self-injections when it's subcutaneous, obviously it's going to be hard if you're aiming for your buttocks, for the intramuscular. But what about if somebody has to do their own injections or chooses to do their own injections? We have a question that came from somebody whose husband has a needle phobia, and she wants to know any – she did not say the type of injection she was giving. I would assume that, those that are given in the belly, she could just easily do herself. I think I know a lot of people who do that themselves. Any suggestions, though?
I would say greater than 80% of patients self-inject. They're lucky enough to have a partner that wants to participate. Obviously, it could take away some of the fear, but especially a subcutaneous injection, it might be easier to do your mixing or dialing up your dose and just injecting into your belly. Whereas the intramuscular injection, while it is possible, we don't really recommend that a patient do their own intramuscular injection. It's a little bit more difficult. Obviously, it's behind you. But at the same time, you're lining up the injection, and it is certainly possible. But the same way I would say 80% of patients do their own subcutaneous, I would say probably 80% or greater do not do their own intramuscular.
Yeah, and you could choose a different muscle if you really have to do it yourself.
You could.
And yeah, so I mean that's an option.
We also offer our nurses to do the injection for our patients that are local.
Yeah, okay. Well, that actually is a good segue into the next question. At the beginning, we talked about a lot of the, very often, fertility meds come in the mail. Why is that? Why do people not go to their local neighborhood pharmacy and pick up their fertility meds like they do their antibiotics and their other prescriptions?
Well, there's a couple of reasons here. One, your regular neighborhood pharmacist has probably never heard of these medications. And if they did,
so
even
true.
If they're just coming out of school, they don't cover fertility medications in great detail in school. And therefore, because the medications do have special storage requirements and the patients that are going through a fertility cycle really are entitled to have professional assistance and help and support through the process, there are a small handful of pharmacies in this country that do specialize in fertility treatments. There is another reason that is surrounding the cost of the medications. And so because there are special handling requirements, because there is special requirements on how we teach the patients how to use the medications, the manufacturers that are in this industry have chosen certain pharmacies to offer additional discounts to. And so those discounts can be in excess of 50% and are only going to be available to the small handful of pharmacies that have demonstrated an expertise in this industry. If you're lucky enough to have insurance, you would have more of a choice because the dollars that are required are less important. But then you might have to accept that your insurance requires you to use their own pharmacy. And you would still, unfortunately, then be stuck receiving them in the mail. So effectively, the expertise that's required is why the clinics seek out certain pharmacies. It's also why the manufacturers of the medication seek out certain pharmacies. And then the piece of the dilutions of HCG or the triggers of Lupron or suppositories require you to be able to compound, and not every compounding pharmacy is a fertility pharmacy and vice versa. However, you would like to be able to receive all your medications from one source, and therefore they can help you the most because they'll have a full medication profile for you.
And if right now you were scratching your head going, how in the world am I supposed to figure all this out? the answer is you really aren't supposed to figure it all out. Your infertility clinic, your doctor is going to be deciding the best protocol and deciding the best drugs for you. And they can help you understand what pharmacy will be carrying the drugs. And I would certainly think that they would be able to give you information on who, depending on what brands you're using, what medication you're using, where you should be going for the best prices. Adam, I would think that clinics certainly, that would be a part of what they're going to be telling their patients.
They've sought out certain pharmacies because they know they're going to take better care of their patients.
Yeah.
And because they know that they're going to be there through the process. The last thing they want is for a patient to need something. Just as an example, one of the things we teach here is when you look at a referral that comes in, the first thing you have to identify is what kind of cycle is the patient doing, and it's very easy to tell whether it's IVF or IUI. And then do I have all the medications required to do the cycle? And, you know, one of the things that occurs is we end up opening up after hours for patients that either were forced to a insurance company's pharmacy or to one that had went locally to a regular mom-and-pop pharmacy who did not know what the medications were being used for and did not know exactly what was needed. And the patient at 10 or 11 o'clock at night identifies they don't have a trigger.
Right.
Unfortunately, this is very common. And we get the phone call either from the patient or from the nurse or from the physician. Can we open up because the patient's in need of doing a trigger this evening? And so the clinics don't want the extra phone call. They also don't want the extra strain and stress on the patient.
Yeah.
So they've chosen certain pharmacies where they know that they're actually going to ensure that the referral is complete and ensure that the patient has what they need when they need it.
Absolutely. So in other words, you aren't left on your own to figure all of this out. your infertility doctor and most probably your infertility nurse are going to be holding your hand, and then you're going to be choosing a pharmacist that's going to be holding your hand and walking you through. So while it may feel overwhelming, the honest truth is that most people, once they start, are far less, it's not as big a deal as they think it's going to be ahead of time. So that is something to keep in mind. Thank you so much, Adam Hite of Schreps 2.0, for being with us today to demystify the whole process. Let me remind everybody that this information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your infertility professional. And there is a lot of information on the Schreff 2.0 site. There are videos, excellent videos, actually, on how to inject, and you don't have to buy from them to utilize their videos. So I recommend, and I'm sure people will want to go and get more information from Schreff, and you can do that at their website, schraffs2.com. That's schraffts2.com. Thank you, everyone, for being with us today, and I will see you next week.
Right now at the Home Depot, you'll save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like a GE Appliances top load washer and dryer pair with deep clean and deep rinse options, a reliable heavy-duty agitator, and four precise water levels, just $478 each. Wash, dry, save, repeat. Today is the day for doing. With Spring Black Friday savings, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more do it. U.S. only while supplies last. Gas dryer extra. See store for details. Valid through April 17th.
Your hands were made for greatness. Mighty hands for painting, paneling, and clicking the submit order button on HomeDepot.com to get that duvet. And these Egyptian cotton towels delivered right to your door. Do more with decor at the Home Depot. Save up to 30% on select bedding and bath. Now at HomeDepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Enter promo code BEDBATH15 at purchase for an extra 15% off. Visit HomeDepot.com for more information.